Hello and welcome to the latest podcast in an ongoing series from the Institute of Leadership and Management. This week we'll be discussing leadership issues which have made the newsstands during the week up to the 5th of April 2019. My name's Nick Scott, I'm an economist and academic working with the Institute of Leadership and Management, and I'm joined today by Kate Cooper, the Institute's Head of Research, Policy and Standards. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Nick.
With the national living wage rising by almost 5% to £8.21 per hour, around 2 million workers will have got a pay rise this April. That won't apply to employees of booksellers Waterstones, which made various news outlets when their chief executive, James Daunt, went on Radio 4 to try to explain why they couldn't pay their lowest paid staff the national living wage. If you raise the bottom really significantly, then everybody all the way up has to go up, and then we go bust, as we're simply not profitable enough to wave the magic wand and shower gold around. So, Kate, is this poor management?
Paying people at the bottom of the organisation a reasonable and fair wage does not mean that you have to inflate salaries all the way through the organisation. I'd be interested to see what is the ratio of his salary, for example, to somebody who works in one of the stores. And if you have a business that is unable to reward its staff fairly for the products and services it provides, the business model is flawed. Obviously, we understand there's so much sentimentality attached to bookstores, and they do provide an environment that so many people are so fond of. But if they're not able to sustain the sorts of revenues that mean that the people who love working in them, because obviously Waterstones are taking advantage of that deep passion their employees have for working in bookstores, then it's not sustainable.
Following his incredibly successful period as a caretaker manager, the confirmed appointment in late March of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as permanent manager of Manchester United has raised the question: what is the key to bringing people with you? Solskjaer, who spent over a decade at the club as a player, has had 14 wins from 19 games since December. This contrasts with his predecessor, Jose Mourinho, who only had 7 wins from the first 17 games of the season. So what does it take as a leader to restore flagging morale of a deflated organisation?
What he has that set him apart, I think, from Mourinho, everything that he believes that Manchester United stands for. There's a commitment that Alex Ferguson invigorated and continued about bringing on young players. And that's what Ollie tapped into, that passion for the brand, for the organisation. So when we're looking for a higher purpose, it's not enough perhaps to say it's football. It's much more than that. It's more local, it's more emotional, and it's about the people who make up, in this case, the Manchester United community, the players, the fans, all of the people who contribute to its success. And though you might see an immediate upturn with a figure as popular as he was returning to take that caretaker role, but what he's been able to do is sustain that honeymoon period to keep delivering results. And of course, there's nothing that breeds success like success.
A new report from the International Workplace Group brings some encouraging news about flexible working, in noting that 62% of companies have some form of policy in place, with over half of employees working outside of their primary headquarters at least 2.5 days a week. On the downside, however, the report states far too many businesses are in fact still falling short of providing the cornerstone requirements for successful flexible working. So, Kate, please remind us of the upsides and expand on why some firms, such as Hewlett-Packard and Yahoo, seem to have been swimming against the tide and calling employees back into the office.
All the research we've done in this area indicates overwhelmingly that employees welcome flexible working. It's a really attractive non-financial benefit. And what we've also recognised is how much more difficult it is to manage, inspire, motivate people that you don't see. It's a whole new communication landscape that you have to work harder at than when you're seeing people every day. The benefits of flexible working, which, as I've already said, from the individual's point of view, are significant. From the organisations, there's obviously the saving in office costs, there's access to much wider talent pools than if you're expecting people to commute to you every day. And because it's seen as a key non-financial benefit, people will often take perhaps a lower salary in order to get that flexibility that flexible working gives them. But if it doesn't work, I have to applaud those people who are saying, this is not working for us, it's not working for the service that we want to provide. And it does make me think, when we hear about new initiatives and great upswings in productivity are reported, and one never really knows whether that's just because of the novelty of the situation or actually there's something that's genuinely underlying that's going to be able to deliver those improvements in the longer term.
Finally, this week marked the now annual reporting of the gender pay gap, and Kate was interviewed by BBC Radio 5 Live.
Right, let's talk about the gender pay gap, shall we? Because thousands of companies have been submitting their data this week before tonight's midnight deadline. Five Live Money's Guy Kilty is here. You've been having a look at what the figures show so far.
Yeah, so since last year, companies with 250 or more employees have been required to submit to the government and publish on their own website their gender pay gap figure. Overall, the figures so far show that on average, the median hourly pay for men is about 10% higher than the median hourly pay for women. That's about the same as last year. Perhaps more interestingly, in three quarters of companies, median hourly pay for men is higher than the median hourly pay for women. Now, Kate Cooper is head of research policy and standards at the Institute of Leadership and Management. Hi, Kate.
Hello, Guy.
So just tell us, I mean, on the face of it, the figures aren't much different from last year, but are things changing?
What is changing is all the attention we're giving it and that we're talking about it now. So that's definitely a change for the better. It was very difficult to start something in 2018, as happened, and know whether that was a typical year or a typical day when you calculated the figure. I think it'll only become meaningful if we look at a trend over time. And I think the fact that we're not seeing so far much of a difference sort of indicates that perhaps the figures were more or less right last year, because 1 year is quite a short time to affect real change when you're looking at recruitment, selection, promotion cycles.
But now the government clearly wants things to change, doesn't it? And that's why it's asking companies to publish this. But is there evidence that things are starting to change? And if so, how are companies making changes?
Well, what they're doing is some of the better ones are creating action plans. They've been given hard and perhaps disappointing data about the size of their gender pay gaps. They're saying this isn't good enough. I know we saw quite a few media companies last year being actually embarrassed about the size of their pay gaps. So what are we going to do? Are we going to actively recruit more women? Are we going to develop the women we've got? Are we going to take a really hard look at what we're asking for a job? And do we really need the years of experience that perhaps we're saying we do? There's so many things you can do, but the important thing is that willingness to change. And yes, there's a moral case, of course, for equal pay, equality of opportunity. But the real thing is there's a compelling business case for diversity. Mm. You want different voices.
Just finally, is it fair to use this figure that they're using? I mean, they're not comparing the same jobs with the same pay, are they? It's looking at the median pay between men and women in the same company. Is that a fair way of comparing the gender pay gap?
Well, I think if you look at the mean and the median together, it's really helpful, because the mean could be distorted by some very highly paid women who'd be quite exceptional and few. Whereas if you look at the middle paid men and compare them to the middle paid women, you get an idea of what's really going on. So I think it'd be wrong to look at them in isolation, but together they give you quite a good and, most importantly, reasonably easy to understand insight.
Okay. Many thanks, Kate. That's Kate Cooper there from the Institute of Leadership and Management on those latest gender pay gap figures. Just to let you know, it's the midnight deadline. We're expecting a few hundred more companies to submit by the deadline tonight.
Well, we're out of time. Please subscribe to this podcast series and visit the website www.institutelm.com to find out more about the Institute of Leadership and Management. We'll be back with more stories next week, and we'll see you then.